From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection for this hour began in your kitchen drawer, where you should have at least one fork that you don't like that you actively frown at if you accidentally grab it. And this should happen by age 35. Maybe this tongue-in-cheek by age 35 meme sounds familiar. It went viral in recent days with advice from millennials on everything from friendships to Tupperware collections to savings accounts. Here are a few examples. By age 35, you should have a collection of excuses for canceling plans and a system in place for how to realistically rotate them. By age 35, you should no longer sacrifice 60 to 90 minutes of your time and a piece of your dignity for a free slice of pizza. And by age 35, you should have twice your salary saved. That last one's a serious one, and it sparked debate. MarketWatch recently published a piece with advice for millennials on how to accomplish that goal. But it has led to some backlash among young adults who say it's not realistic, and discussion about the retirement crisis. Millennials are pointing to college loans, low-paying jobs, and more. Well, while all of that debate was percolating, the story of a 30-year-old man in Syracuse went viral. Michael Rotondo had been living with his parents rent-free for years. His parents accused him of freeloading and repeatedly told him they wanted him to leave. When he didn't, his parents took him to court, and a judge sided with Rotondo's parents. Now he has an eviction notice. Critics are fired up over the story. Some are saying that Rotondo characterizes the, quote, typical millennial. We don't think that's fair, but there's a lot to talk about this hour. And we've invited, yes, I hate the term, I know, but local millennials to help us parse things out. We're going to talk finances, forks, and more. I'd like to welcome our guest for the hour. Sarah Jones is a PR account executive with Dixon Schwabel, firmly ensconced in the millennial generation. Welcome, Sarah. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks, Evan. Thanks for having me.
Also here is Matt Wagstaff, who's the manager of new sales channels at Excellus BCBS. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Chuck Wade is vice president and financial advisor for Brighton Securities, who said earlier, I guess I'm a millennial. You are, right?
I never know.
You are?
We were talking about this before the show. What's the cutoff? I was born in 84, so I
think it's like 81 or 2.
All right, so yeah, I'm in then.
You're in under the line.
So I'm in. I've never thought of myself as one, but I'm in.
Okay. Well, before we get going with some of our conversation about really what is realistic in terms of saving, accomplishing those goals, the challenges that this generation is facing. We invite your feedback on this. And yeah, if you want, you can come up with your own by age 35 advice. Maybe before the end of the hour, our guests should give their own by age 35 advice. One of my favorite ones was about Tupperware containers. By age 35, you should have an entire cabinet filled with Tupperware containers that don't match. Just a bunch of random bottoms and tops that come cascading out every time you open the door.
That is so true.
That's accurate.
That is so true. Where are all the pens in my house? They're with the Tupperware tops that do not match any of the Tupperware bottoms that I have.
Evan, you're describing my home perfectly.
I know, exactly. It's not just millennials, it's everybody. But let's listen to a little bit of the Michael Rotondo interview. By the way, he had to come here to WXXI to do this. And if you watch the interview on CNN, you go, oh, that's the backdrop of Rochester. Yeah, he was shooting that from WXXI as a satellite interview. He's talking to CNN's Brooke Baldwin, and the 30-year-old starts by saying he wants to get out of his parents' house, but...
The fact that you were on national television talking about moving out of your parents' house, you tell me you want to move out of your parents' house. Why don't you just move out of your parents' house, like, tomorrow?
I don't have the means to do that tomorrow.
Okay. So, do you have a job?
No.
Are you trying to get a job? Because I read that one of the things your parents asked of you, there are jobs available even for those with a poor work history like you. Get one, you have to work. Are you working on that?
I have plans to be able to provide myself with the income I need to support myself, but it's not something that's going to come together tomorrow. So. I'm trying to do what's best for me, and you know, I do want to leave, and I want to leave as soon as possible. But you know, it's not tomorrow. I don't think it should have to be tomorrow. And
you want it to be tomorrow. It just isn't tomorrow because you don't have the means yet to make it tomorrow. There are a lot of people who have read about your story, and the thought bubble is, what is up with this millennial generation that you guys seem so entitled? What would you say to those critics?
I would say that I'm really not a member of that demographic that they're speaking to, of that group. I'm a very conservative person. The millennials that they're speaking to are very liberal in their ideology.
But you're 30, so technically I think you are part of the millennial generation. I don't think there's a delineation between...
You're right. When people speak to the millennials and their general nature as a millennial, they speak to more liberal leanings.
Okay. This is Michael Rotondo and Brooke Baldwin on CNN. So there you go. And I'm just going to start with this. I mean, Sarah Jones, I imagine you think that your generation gets unfairly stereotyped.
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, I think anytime that you decide to create a blanket statement about an individual group, especially an entire generation that spans over 15 years, I mean, we as millennials are individuals. So taking one person and extrapolating their story across an entire generation is never going to work out.
Unfair.
Yeah, very unfair.
How often do you hear it?
I actually hear it less than I used to. I think first when we were coming up as a generation, maybe 10 years ago or so, it was more of a, you know, more of an issue and a buzzword. But there's still some remaining stereotypes and articles and think pieces on millennials. But I think as we start to become a huge part of the workforce and as we rise up the ranks in terms of, you know, different companies and industries, we're kind of proving them wrong. So.
And by the way, just for the conversational piece of this, Rotondo's very different than you. You live at home for a different reason.
I do, yes. I live at home, and I am turning 30 this summer, so I'm around the same age as Rotondo. I actually went to Washington, D.C. after graduating from college, worked at a nonprofit, admittedly lived outside of my means for about 5 years, in a high-rent area, and came back and also got my master's degree while I was in D.C., so I'm paying off my master's degree, paying off my undergraduate degree, paying off credit card expenses, and saving for a house. So it's pretty hard, and also saving for retirement. So it's hard to accomplish all that while having savings, while paying rent. And some of my peers are getting married, having children. So there's a lot of financial stress on everyone, including those of my generation.
But there's pragmatism for you living at home, and that's very different than what you heard in that interview.
Yes.
With someone who doesn't need that much of a plan at all.
No, yes. Yeah, not much of a plan at all. I would say that he is not a representative of our generation. I mean, especially in his top to bottom. And I mean, once you dig in deeper to this story, you understand that there's issues with, he has a son and there's issues with custody. There's legal issues that he has. There's obviously an issue between him and his parents. So I think, you know, taking this one story, it's very easy to take the headline, 30-year-old evicted by parents in court, and use that to define a generation. But, he is definitely not the typical millennial.
If Chuck Wade were the financial advisor for both Sarah Jones and Michael Rotondo, I think he'd have very different things to say about two people living at home. I mean, Sarah's doing the right thing, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's there's nothing wrong with living at home, especially if you're going to use that as an opportunity to save money, if you're going to use that as an opportunity to further yourself, or if you have other experiences you want to have that doing that will just make it easier for you to do. There's nothing wrong with doing that. At all.
If so you've much got of parents who are okay with
well,
it, too.
Well, right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in his case, his parents did offer him money. They offered him $1,100 at one point to go, here, we'll give you some money. Go off and start on your own. So, I mean, that case to me, I looked at it. At first, I laughed at it. And then I read it and I thought, oh, my gosh, this is such a sad story. Like, this is really, it's a complete outlier to any generation. I mean, you say, all right, well, millennials are lazy and entitled. Okay, are there not people in the generation prior to us that were entitled and lazy? And are there not people in the generation that will come after us that are entitled and lazy?
I've actually done the research. There was zero.
Oh, zero.
Okay, so I'm wrong. Okay.
Being lazy and entitled was invented in 1982.
Okay, so we did it.
maybe 1981, yeah.
So I guess I just look and say, I mean, people are people. I don't think we're that different. I think this is the generation that's under the microscope right now. So people are willing to pick and choose our strength from our strengths and weaknesses. And for everyone who says, well, millennials are entitled, I can tell you there's people I work with that are out there hustling every day, trying to make themselves better, trying to improve their financial situation and seeking the knowledge to do it. And what they get is they realize, oh, I can. It may be challenging. It may be difficult, but it's by no means impossible.
Yeah, let me ask Matt Wagstaff how you felt about even Brooke Baldwin's question him, which I think was fair just because of the sort of the virality of the Michael Rotondo story and the way that non-millennials love to. I think Chuck's making a good observation. Older generations love to jump on the current youngest generation of adulthood. Just as millennials, you will all do that to the next generation. I know you're going to do it.
Already am.
Chuck, sorry. Those Gen Zs.
Yeah. Is that what it is, Gen
yeah.
Z?
Mm-hmm.
Those Gen Zs.
It's always like the, back in my day, right?
Yeah.
And then you young whippersnappers don't really know how it was back when I was growing up and those things.
Do you buy any of that?
I don't. I think it's all relative, right? So for me, it's really around, I think the generation before us even created kind of the monster that we have today. And then they want to judge us, right? Or they want to judge the generations that are coming after them. The generation of you can be all that you want to be. You can be anything in this world, right? But the reality is you really can't be anything that you want to be, right? I think there were some false perceptions there or some false expectations that were set up and kind of get people set up that way. And most times you probably don't want to be the things that you dreamed up of as a kid, as things have changed. And at the end of the day, how are you adding value to society? I think that our parents and our grandparents and our aunts and uncles may have set us up for this illusion, right, that we think that we can be anything. So then we go out, we try to do things that have very, very, very low value to society, and then we come back and we're wondering why we have $100,000 of student loan debt for a degree that has zero value in society, or why we are just impulsive by nature to do shopping and all these types of experiential type of activities. But also, previous generations have set us up from an economic standpoint, where we are to a certain extent. When you think of the 2008-2007 crash, you know, that wasn't set up by necessarily millennials, right? You think about previous generations that have set that up, with the help probably of some millennials, but the Gen Xers and previous generations, baby boomers, probably set that up as well to a certain extent.
It's almost like Matt can see the call board, because in a moment I'm going to grab Rich in Rochester's phone call first off the board, who is right on this subject.
Yeah.
He's with you, and we're going to turn to Rich in a second, but I know, Chuck, you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, Michael, something you said, there's studies that have been done on how previous generations influence, on how parents influence their children. And we see it with money. And there's actually, you know, what we realize to be how if a mother and father make too much money, how it can have a detrimental effect on their kids unless they're willing to set parameters. And a great example would be, you know, instead of telling someone, you know, telling your kid, no, you can't have that toy. Tell them why they can't have it. Is it you can't have that because we can't afford it? Or is it you can't have that, we can afford it, we're choosing not to, and here's why. And how do we create things like that sense of entitlement? A lot of the times, and that responsibility is on us now, those of us who have kids, to help fashion them. And so they have an understanding of, yeah, you know what, you could have this, but you're not going to right now, and here's why. Maybe you could work for this. Maybe we could set something up where you earn it. And then we'll help you out with it. And I think a lot of the times that's forgotten or that's lost is that, you know, there's a great responsibility on the generation that is raising the next generation that will come up.
All right, so let me grab our first phone call. And we've got Sarah Jones, Chuck Wade, Matt Wagstaff in studio with us. And you can join the program 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Maybe that's an important question as we go throughout the hour. You know, I think Sarah makes an important point that people are people. And to Chuck's point, I mean, no generation invents entitlement or laziness. But do you think there are hallmarks of the millennial generation? I actually think there's a lot of good hallmarks of this generation. But what comes to mind for you, and is that fair? Rich in Rochester. Go ahead, Rich.
Hello. How you doing today?
Good.
Evan.
Yeah.
I have to agree with your guest that was just speaking. Every single generation looks back and says, look at these lazy or good for nothing or entitled kids. Totally ignoring the fact that they raised them. You know, it's like if we were such great parents and if our kids, if we knew everything, we did so good, why are our kids like this? This constant blame and this constant looking at a child, our children's world through our eyes, when we never even experienced that with those, their world, except through them as being our children. In the end, first of all, the word lazy, I think that word, for the lack of a better word, is lazy. I think it's a sort of a useless word. These children have a set of parameters that we set. My parents didn't set the parameters because they didn't have the money, so I knew I had to go out. Because we have taught our children that we will help them along. You can stay here. You can save $75,000 and move out when you want to go buy your house. Whereas I left my house with a couch or whatever, and that's what I did. But that's what I had to work with, and I worked with it. Those are the parameters that were set for me. My children, are their parameters are set different. Like you said, there was because, and I always think because of World War II, the rest of the world was wrecked, and so the U.S. had this real artificial position of preeminence, so there was all this money flowing around this country from education to everything. So my generation, I'm a baby boomer, 60, right at the end, 1960. We had almost an artificial world, and our children, I think, are living a more realistic world of competition. So I think this whole thing of blaming our children, if anything, we had it easy. We just walked into some factory and was making $50,000 a world doing nothing. I mean, a year doing nothing.
Well,
you have to be skilled. You have to be educated, all of that stuff.
And, Rich, you know, this whole by age 35 meme, here's one that goes right along with what you're saying there, Rich. By age 35, you should have a backup career path plan because what you went to college for probably isn't going to support you your entire life. That's not a joke. That's a serious by age 35. And so to Rich's point there, that is a demarcated line in generations for sure. People who are graduating now, or people who are in their 20s, people who are turning 30, are not necessarily thinking, I can do this exact thing my entire life, and that will be it when I'm 60 or 65 or 70 or 80, and then I retire. That mindset has changed. So, Rich, I appreciate that. And, Matt, that really lines up with a lot of you had to say there. I mean, you know, it's almost like previous generations want to mock without feeling like they've got anything to do with the way kids turn out.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the apple doesn't fall where, right? Too far from the tree, right?
That's right.
And kind of have to look in the mirror a little bit when you're evaluating your own children specifically, right? So if I look at my daughter and my son and I see that there's some issues there, I have to kind of do a little bit of reflecting on myself and kind of the things that I've done to build that culture in them, and those mindsets that I've placed in them and the environment that I put them in, right? To see, what influences I've had over their lives and why they feel entitled or enabled to be a certain way or think a certain way or act a certain way. So absolutely, I agree with what our caller was saying.
All right, so let me go around the table and ask on the main premise that kind of sparked all of this by age 35 stuff, MarketWatch saying by age 35, you should have twice your average annual salary saved. Sarah Jones, mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
I personally feel that it's unrealistic. I mean, I started saving into a 401k when I began my career at 22. So that's just about 8 years ago. And then, like I said, the decisions that I made in my life. So I went to a private undergraduate college. And then I went to a major city and worked at a nonprofit. So my life choices don't necessarily lend to saving twice my salary. And I don't think that I'm alone. A lot of my peers I know are working two jobs to afford rent or to afford a savings or a 401k, health care. And that's, barring any type of marriage or children. So I would say it's completely unrealistic, at least for myself and my peers. I can't speak for, the entire generation, but.
Chuck, is it unrealistic?
I think we should ask a different question. I think the question's a blanket question and one that's easy to get clicks. I think more realistically would be by age 35, you should try to be saving triple the amount into your 401k than you were when you started. So let's say you started at 3% and you increased and you started at 23, when most people are leaving college, you start at your first job, putting 3% of your income, which if you're making, that's not a huge chunk. You probably wouldn't even notice it. And so by the time you're 35, 12 years later, what if you increased it 1% every year? Again, would you miss 1% of your income every year? You probably wouldn't even notice it. But if you do that every year and say, January 1st, I'm going to bump it up 1%, you've more than tripled what you're saving by the time you're 35. That, to me, is a more realistic expectation and goal. to shoot for than just say, well, I need to have twice my income saved up by the time I'm 35. I don't know that question is fair. I don't think it is.
Yeah, and you know, I know you work with clients at Brighton Securities from a lot of different backgrounds, and the last thing you want to do is make someone, whether it's Sarah Jones or anybody else, walk in the door feel like, you know, scolded, or what you, especially with a generation that has college loan debt, which we've talked about more than any other prior generation, other forms of debt, a marketplace of jobs that definitely is more in flux. So I grant all of those points. So we can concede that while also saying, for the Michael Rotondos are saying, well, what am I going to do? We can be a little firm with, I think, as his parents tried to be, right?
Like,
there are certain things you can do to change your situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the times it just starts with asking, what can I do to better myself? You know, Sarah, you came in, you said, well, I've talked to a financial planner. So you're asking the questions. That's what you can do, is ask the questions. How can I put myself in a better situation? And the other part of that is, you know, maybe is to figure out what do you want out of life? What is your goal? Maybe it's not to retire at 55. You know what? Because I know it's not mine. Mine isn't retiring at 55. I like what I do. Some people like working. And especially, look, pensions are gone for this generation. So I think our generation is going to have to work a little longer. But maybe you want to have experiences. Maybe you want to do something else. If retiring in your early 50s isn't your primary goal, let's find out what your goals are and work towards those.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Matt, how do you feel about the whole 35 have twice your average annual salary saved?
First thing is, it depends on what your salary is, right? If it's realistic or not, right?
So absolutely.
Your salary is you know, X dollars, and maybe that's more realistic than others. So if your salary is $1 million a year, maybe you don't have $2 million saved up. If it's $35,000, maybe you do. But I think, Chuck, your point around kind of what your goals in life are, I think that's a huge question that needs to be answered. And I kind of live off the philosophy. I didn't coin this phrase, but I definitely live by it when I'm speaking about financial literacy in general, is the statement of just live long and prosper. And you can dissect that in a lot of different ways as far as living life based on two things. You want to live long and you want to prosper. What does prosperity mean? You want to be happy. What does happiness mean? It's subjective depending on the person that you're talking about. We only get one shot at this life. There's no do-overs, right? You only get one. You can't play again after it's over. When it's done, it's done. So you have to reflect as far as understanding what you want to get out of this life. How does money play a role in you sustaining life as well as being happy in the life that you have? So I think that it depends on what those goals are, depends on what you value in life. It depends on your situation, your economic situation, your socioeconomic situation. It may take you some more time to get out of a ditch that your family may have dug you in, starting getting you off behind the rat race, if you will, depending on your situation in life, whether it be culturally, through your gender or geographically. You could definitely be starting off at a disadvantage, but that doesn't mean that you are in a permanent, perpetual state of disadvantage.
Matt talked a lot about values and thinking about work that has societal value, and I can't help but thinking about what Jeff Bezos recently said, you know, that once you have as much money as he does, what, $100 billion worth or more, you know, he's got to look to space to solve problems because he just sort of can't figure out anything to do with it here. And all the people in Flint, Michigan were like, we got something, but... you know, it's just amazing how we can lose sight of some of those values. And I appreciate it. And this is one thing that I do hear this generation, millennials, if you want to call it, talk a little bit more than previous generations, was not just work, but also impact on societal value.
Yeah.
That's a generalization, but I do hear that a lot.
It's huge. It is huge. Again, I can't stress this enough. You get one shot at this thing. Depending on however long it is, you only get one shot at it. So why not make it the best, right? And really understand what makes you happy, regardless of what that is. Whatever makes you happy, you want to try to do that. And where does money play a role in it? Money is just a part of life. It's not life, right? It's important part of life, but it's not life as a whole. So is it realistic? Again, it all depends on the situation. It depends on your network. It depends on your family. It depends on, some people just have good genes. Some people have good genetics. Some people get sicker than others. They have medical bills that cause them to not be able to save. Some people are just naturally good sellers, which gives them a propensity to have a higher income. It's just a lot of different variables. So I can't say, yes, it is realistic or it isn't realistic. It all depends on the person.
All right, so I've got to get an early break of the hour, and then I've got a couple of emails I want to read. Tim in Pittsburgh, going to get your comments next. Tim always wants to knock millennials, and he's got a chance to tee up the Michael Rotondo story, but we'll see what Tim has to say when we come back. Also, I thought it was Bertha in Greece. It's Martha in Greece. And I thought, it can't be Bertha, because I don't know anybody. There are certain names that I don't hear anymore. And I want to be proven wrong. I want the youngest Bertha in our listening audience to call me. I want, you know, there's certain names that are just not in the millennial generation.
And that's one of them.
That's one of them, right?
Oh, yes. For sure.
Yes.
But everything old is new again. It's all coming back.
Very true.
We're talking about a lot of different sort of conflating stories this week, not the least of which is this meme, by age 35. MarketWatch did a story saying by age 35, you should have twice your average annual salary saved. They got a lot of pushback from people who are 35 and younger saying very, very easy to say that, harder to do given all the challenges this generation is facing. But we're talking about that, how to work through that, and a lot of different things about stereotypes, what we think about when we say the word millennials, and a lot more. Our guests include Matt Wagstaff, Matt's manager of new sales channels at Excellus BCBS, Chuck Wade, vice president and financial advisor for Brighton Securities, Sarah Jones, PR account executive with Dixon Schwabel. You can call the program if you like, and we'll read some of those emails when we come back. Coming up in our second hour, New York State Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli joins us in studio for the hour. He's running for Congress, one of four Democrats running for the seat that was held for so long by the late Louise Slaughter. You've heard on this program from the other three Democrats. Today it's Joe Morelli. Our chance to explore the issues with him and his priorities for going to Washington. Joe Morelli, next hour. All right, welcome to Connections. This is Connections, continuing with you on your NPR news station here, WXXI. I'm Evan Dawson. And before we jump into some of these emails, you know, Chuck is making the point, and Matt and Sarah have raised really interesting points about goals, and it's not everybody wanting to retire at 55 or 60, maybe like some of these really aggressive financial goals you'll hear. But for somebody who does, somebody who's 30, who walks into your office and says, you know, I haven't saved a dime, I want to retire at 55. I would like to move out with my parents. I want to get up and really start moving. What do you tell them to do?
All right, let's get to work. And I mean, like, all right, let's start mapping that out. You know, one of the things that's really interesting and that you don't realize often is it's a lot easier to go from, say, 50,000 to 100,000 in your 401k than it is to go from 1 to 50. So let's get started. And the reason is, when you build the base up, then you not only are you continuing to put money in, but you've got a chunk that's already growing and compounding and earning interest and growing upon itself. So, you know, we have to take kind of a long-term view, but the key is, well, then let's get started. Let's talk about, you know, what's your income situation right now? What are your expenses? If you don't have extra income that you think you could save, well, let's find places you can. Let's look at your at budgeting. But then let's also bring up the idea about go work a part-time job. If you really want to do this, then you can do it. But you have to be willing to put in the sweat equity to have the, you know, the literal equity. So go get another job for a little while. I mean, you can do it. Let's map out a plan if that's your goal.
All right, let's get Tim's email here. Tim in Pittsburgh, teeing up millennials, one of his favorite punching bags. And by the way, what I'm about to read from Tim calls back to the by age 35 meme. And I mentioned earlier, one of my favorite was, by age 35, you should have an entire cabinet filled with Tupperware containers that don't match. I'm going to ask our guest for the end of the hour to share their by age 35 single advice meme. But here's Tim's email. He says, first off, I have at least 25 Tupperware containers without matches, easily. Next, that interview was awesome. I consider Michael Rotondo to be a great example for millennials. Tongue-in-cheek, obviously, but one thing I hear constantly from millennials is, what can you do for me? So I don't know if millennials are truly lazy, but maybe just selfish? Okay, we're going to get that point, because I'm not sure our guests will agree, but thank you, Tim. And then he has a separate question for Chuck. He says, finally for Chuck, is it wrong that I have poured a ton of money into my retirement accounts instead of having a savings that double my salary at 40 years old?
No, I don't think so. I mean, he's saving the money. I mean, he's 40. As long as you have the understanding of, you know, where you are, what your goals, needs, and expectations are. But that's also probably something that's better for another conversation another time, because there's a lot of that answer that would have to do with Tim's personal situation and scenario.
Okay. Well, you know where to find Chuck, Tim. But thanks for the email. Now, on the subject of whether it's true, Tim's idea that he hears constantly from millennials is, what can you do for me? Matt, do you hear that from your generation?
No, not really. I think it's... I don't know. I think I'm just different to a certain extent, too. I'm always asking, specifically like my management, my leadership, what can I do for them, really? Again, I live off of value creation. At the end of the day, if you're not creating value for yourself, society, others, that's really the point of this whole thing, right, is to be able to contribute and grow and expand on society. So, no, I don't hear too much of a, what can you do for me? It's more of a, how can we have a mutual relationship? Again, maybe that's just a different circle. I don't know, and I don't want to put a broad brush on this generation, but I personally don't hear too much of what can you do for me. I see it more of being reciprocal in nature.
Okay,
and we need more Matt. We need more Matt.
I would agree with Matt. I think it's more of a reciprocal relationship. I think gone are the days of pensions and 30-year careers at the same company and, you know, a steady progression up the ladder. I think, you know, you often hear about millennials only spending a few years at a particular job and hopping around, asking for promotions. And I think that that's a result of, you know, A, the financial situation we discussed at length, but also we've been taught that we have to invest in ourselves and invest in our careers in order to go somewhere. So if we're putting in time at a four-year degree, if we're doing unpaid internships, if we're doing time at different positions, we do expect, you know, the company that we work for to have a mutual relationship. So if we're not seeing the benefits of working at a particular company, we'll go to a new company. So that sense of, I guess, mutual loyalty, you know, if I'm working at, I'm lucky to work at a company that provides that, so I will spend time at that company. But if millennials aren't seeing that, then yeah, it is a more, you know, what can we do for each other, and I'll be ready to move on.
Okay, Jack?
Yeah, let me answer that question with another question. Is stop and think, how many millennials are you really hearing that from? And a great example to that, to kind of illustrate that, is, so Bruce Springsteen played a concert here, I think, a couple years ago. And I remember that Sunday morning saying to my wife, gosh, everyone was at that concert. And then I realized, no, three or four people I knew on Facebook were at that concert. But I was seeing it. And I was seeing a picture, and then I'd see it. So it was almost like this vacuum that I felt like I was in. And I think it's a great example of any of anything is, well, how many people are you really hearing that from? Is it really a large group? Because if it is, okay, well, maybe there's something there. Or is it a small group that maybe is just concentrated in your circle? And maybe it seems like more of a problem than it really is because it's just magnified due to your experiences.
That's such a smart point. I mean, first of all, I guarantee you I can find a story of someone a generation ago, parents evicting a child, that didn't go viral. And mm-hmm. if, let's say there were another Michael Rotondo story. Let's say it's a 28-year-old who gets evicted next week, and this happens in Michigan. Do you know what everyone's going to say? Well, that's... I guess it's happening everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's a trend.
What a typical generation. We don't do a very good job with statistics and extrapolation. We over-extrapolate.
Yeah.
That's a really good point. That's very fair. So, Tim, the allegation is that that's what you're doing. Come at us, Tim.
I'll say one thing, too. Just getting back to the whole value piece real quick, if I could just add one thing. I would say from a what can you do for me perspective, it would be similar to how can you add value to my life, right? So if I'm gonna invest time in a relationship or in anything, right, you want it to be reciprocal in that nature. So I guess you could spin it that way to say, well, what can you do for me in that sense, and even at a job, right? You know, how are you going to help me in my life? As far as the goals that I have. So I could see it that way, but I don't see it being blatantly, mm-hmm. you know, what are you going to do for me? And there's not going to be anything that I'm going to give to you in return.
Yeah. And to Sarah's point, you know, if millennials will stay at companies that are loyal to them and treat them well, but we do see a lot of jobs sort of jumping, does that have more to say about corporate culture and how people and companies are treating workers who happen to be the youngest part of the workforce, millennials right now, rather than millennials being fickle?
I would say maybe it's a product of both. So we are again, not to generalize our entire generation, but experiences and value. And a lot of times you see a large pay jump if you move from one company to another, or you get to experience a new part of the industry. To your point earlier about careers, I mean, I was in college right during the recession. So at the beginning of college, I thought I was going to be a print journalist. By the end of college, I said, you know, maybe my opportunities are elsewhere based on, you know, the current economic climate and you know, the opportunities in that career. So, you know, I've made different decisions, gone different directions. And, you know, I just think that it depends on, you know, what you're looking for.
Yeah. And to that point, we're in a society, too. I mean, there's a lot of headhunting that goes on, too. I mean, a lot of times people leave jobs not because they were actively seeking, but because they were sought. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we see that a lot more now. You've got LinkedIn where you'll see someone and like, oh, I got a LinkedIn request. Well, this person's a recruiter for so-and-so. Boom. Without fail, within a day or two, mm-hmm. there's an email. Hey, I'm interested in connecting. Would you be interested in exploring this opportunity? It happens all the time. And I think that's different than in previous generations, too, because of how connected we are.
Yeah, and how rapidly industries are changing as well. So you could, you know, start a job in one aspect of the industry. And then, for mm-hmm. example, in mine, I work in advertising. So the social media is constantly changing, as I know all of you know. So it's just you have to be agile. And sometimes agile means moving from company to company.
You want to add to that, Matt?
Yeah, definitely. So I've been with Excellus. It'll be 11 years on June 4th, right? So I think I'm against the modern trend, I'm not the typical, right? And a lot of that has to do with the culture at the organization, right? So not to be the spokesperson for my company, but the culture has a lot to do with me wanting to stay there and wanting to participate mm-hmm. in it. Mm-hmm. I think that our generation, I guess, if you will, the millennials, and again, I still don't even think of myself as a millennial. I'm right on the border right there. But if I had to be in that bucket, I think a lot of us are looking at lifetime learning as another way of fulfilling value in our life. So the way in which we fulfill that need is through different experiences, whether it be professionally or personally. So if it's a professional experience that you have an opportunity to embark upon, you may, if you don't have the commitments or the things holding you back, the anchors holding you down, whether it be family commitments or health, et cetera, you feel some freedom to be able to go and do those things and be perfectly fine with it.
I also want to ask all three of you about a comment I heard earlier this week on the show that was really interesting to me. It came from a woman who is an urban designer, sort of a public space planner, and she is in the millennial generation. And she said that the reason that coffee shops are so hot, spaces like that, public parks, are because her generation loves to meet face to face, and that the stereotype that a millennial is always on their phone is true when they are waiting for things. She said millennials do fill their time waiting for someone to show up, or on a bus or a train, or in an Uber or whatever, always on a phone, communicating, checking stuff, whatever. There isn't a whole lot of contemplation and relaxed, quiet thought. But when they get together, the goal is to get together face-to-face and not just on screens. And she really believes that's a mistaken idea about this generation. I don't know how you feel about that, Sarah. What do you think?
I would agree. I mean, I think there's benefits to both. Actually, as part of my graduate education, I studied interpersonal interactions online and in person. So you do get that nonverbal communication when you're with each other, and I think that there's a major benefit to that. And I do think that my friends, at least the case study of one, that we enjoy both. So we'll be texting each other and we'll exist in that electronic world. But I really value being face-to-face with a person and spaces that allow that to happen. So breweries, coffee shops, you know, public spaces are really valuable to me. And I find myself reflecting as I'm doing them. You know, yesterday I was at a brewery with friends, and you know, you're out in the sunshine, you're enjoying yourselves, you're enjoying your company.
Are you talking to one another, or
yes,
are all of you on your screens?
I would say that if we are on our screens, we acknowledge that we are on our screens. So, you know, I had a friend who someone was coming to buy his couch. So he had to monitor his phone to see if
sure.
she was coming. So it's something, you know, along those lines. So we're not, you know, the typical millennial, I'm doing the motion of looking down at my phone right now. You know, we're not doing that.
Yeah, because the joke is you could go out to a brewery with your friends, but even in talking to each other, you're just texting each other across the table.
Yes, yeah. And I, you know, my friends and I don't do that. I mean, we are on our phones checking for other things if they're important, or, you know, we joke every once in a while there will be a lull in the conversation, and all of a sudden we'll look up and realize, oh my gosh, we're all on our phones. But we laugh about it, we put our phones down, we pick up the conversation again.
Okay, Chuck Wade.
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Like, I see both sides of it. I mean, I see the addiction we have to our phones, myself included, and I can't stand that. I see, but yeah, I do agree. I mean, I think there are a lot, I see a lot of people having experiences with each other. That's really cool. I don't know. I also live in a world, too, where my priority is my family, so I don't do as much getting together with, you know, friends as I used to, because my wife and I, you know, choose to spend our time with our kids as much as we can. But, you know, in that, we've had to set a rule for ourselves, is that when we come home, we throw the phones in the bowl, and we don't come back, go back to them, because we've realized it is a tight line to walk, and it can be pretty challenging.
That's fair. Okay. Matt?
Yeah, I think it's a function, at least personally speaking, of me trying to do a lot at one time. So I'm trying to maximize my time, really, especially when I'm waiting for something, right? So if you have some work emergencies you're trying to handle, or you have things you're trying to plan for the weekend, if you have kids or anything like that, you're trying to maximize that time. If you have business things you need to do, you may be on social media trying to handle you know, posts for your business. It could be a variety of different things. I don't think that... folks are just being kind of lazy or just casually, leisurely doing these things. I think there is a population of folks who are just, you know, just browsing Facebook while they're waiting. But especially when you're meeting with people, if you're having dinner or lunch or coffee in the morning with folks, I can't remember a time where I was with someone having breakfast or having coffee where I had my phone out and I was intentionally like texting my wife or on the phone looking at Instagram or something while I'm with them. I could see us having a conversation about progress in life, essentially, and me maybe looking at my phone to find a website to give them, you know, that type of thing. But
yeah. Not to distract from them.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is why I think this generation and future generations, what do you call it, what's the Gen Z?
Yes.
And the Gen Zs are really going to push more public transportation, self-driving cars, etc. Because the act of driving a car is just inefficient.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'll tell
it's
you.
Just what, it's just from an efficiency standpoint.
I'll tell you one thing. Every morning, I just got this new rule, actually, the last month or so. You see today, I wear a white shirt and blue jeans. I wear exactly the same uniform almost every day to work when I can, because I don't even want to think about it when I wake up in the morning. So how do you maximize your morning?
You're like Barack Obama in the suits.
I don't even
reduce
want to think about it.
Reduce your decision fatigue.
I got so much stuff to think about in the morning. I just want to just get dressed and leave, right? I just one less decision or a decision I can use that later for a more important decision. So, yeah, how do you maximize time?
Yeah, that is very interesting to me. By the way, in the notion of meeting face-to-face, here's another cheeky by age 35. By age 35, you should run into friends and say, we should hang out soon, twice a week. Mm-hmm. You will never hang out. You'll just scream this at each other until one of you dies.
You know, that happened last summer.
Oh my God.
It happens.
I started to try
to do that. We did that with a neighbor. I said, no, we're going to do this. We have to set a date
doing
right
it.
Now.
Yeah. We're doing yes. it.
Like, nobody's leaving until we've picked a date.
If you don't set a date,
because we won't.
Never happen.
Then the phones come out. Then the phones come out, right?
Right. Yeah. Then the phones come out so we can check our calendars, which is fine in that case.
Yeah. And even if you do set a date, you may cancel it and you may still never do it.
Sure, somebody's going to cancel.
You may still never do it. So that one's kind of funny, but true.
Yeah.
Oh, very true.
Absolutely.
I have to get out my calendar, put the date in my calendar and save it and make sure. But my thing is, going back to efficiencies, if I would rather sit and scroll on Instagram than hang out with you, then I just won't hang out with you, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, of course.
You know?
That's a good
so,
point.
So it's the workday doesn't end at 5. You know, we all have to be more efficient and more productive with our time. And so if I'm out with friends, then I've made a conscious decision. It's opportunity cost. So I've made a conscious decision to be out with friends and to be in the space. So I will be in the space. And, you know, if it's something that I don't want to be doing, then I won't be doing it because my time is precious.
All right, let me get Martha's email. Martha says, some advice. I didn't go to a financial advisor when I wasn't doing well financially because I thought you needed a certain amount of money to start with an advisor. But that's not true at all. It's never a bad idea to ask for help and then start projecting into the future. Chuck, I know you didn't write that email. I think you could have. Was that your alter ego who wrote that?
I don't know. She nailed it. Was it Barbara?
Martha.
Martha. Martha nailed it. It wasn't Bertha.
It was not Bertha. I thought it was Bertha.
No, she nailed it. I mean, we see that with people. But you see that with people who have significant sums of money, too, that are intimidated by that. That will say, oh, I didn't know if I had enough. That's one of the reasons we don't have minimums. We don't have a number. I don't care. I mean, we don't care if you have zero or if you got 10 million. Like, let's get to work. And let's figure it out. I mean, Whether you work to save $30,000 or $300,000, and that's your life savings, that's a big deal, and we have to respect that, and we have to be cognizant of that. And you've both mentioned time. That's where we provide our greatest value, I think, is let us spend the time on that. So you can have the time to do what you want, whether that's retire, whether that you wanna be able to spend time with your family or have experiences. Our best value is time. We can work to give you that time by spending our time on that.
I think there's another important point, because I'm going to tie it back to Matt's constant invocation of value, is that let's say you're in Sarah's situation or Martha saying, you know, I didn't have hardly anything. I didn't go to an advisor until later in life. I think this generation would like to be able to give more charitably, but certain people have this idea that until I make X, I can't give to charity. And that's also wrong. I mean, what I have learned throughout my life is whatever your income is, in the same way that you sort of pay yourself, Chuck talked about 1% set aside, then increase that every year, you can do that with charitable giving if you make $16,000 a year. And again, I know there's privilege to charitable giving. I mean, I understand that entirely. But for a generation that cares very much, you don't have to wait, I think, to at least make some connection to
or give your time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my wife and I put together Ziploc bags of protein and granola bars and Band-Aids and first aid kits. And that's what we give to people who we see panhandling. Didn't cost us anything.
It's interesting you say that. It's been a while. I've not refilled the bags in my car.
Yeah.
I keep bags in my car.
Got like 10 of them in each car. And you know what? It cost us a couple of bucks, but it doesn't cost you anything. Or give your time. Mm-hmm. It doesn't cost anything to do that. And I think that's a huge part of this generation is wanting to give back to others. It doesn't cost anything to do that.
Yeah, and I think giving time is very important, especially because a lot of my peers are focused on changing things systemically. So when you are looking at the root of the problem and how you would like to greatly impact actionable change, giving your time and your value and your input and your knowledge is a lot more valuable than obviously money runs the world and it's something that's very necessary. But if we want to make actionable change, then we have to show up.
All right. So last couple of minutes here, I want to ask our guest just a little bit about what Michael on Twitter said. He thinks that the conversation about Michael Rotondo, the 30-year-old who was evicted from living with his parents, is a little bit of self-righteous punching down. And he says, it's been wonderful having our grown kids in the house, and I'm confident they'll be on their own in 3 years. I take the point, Michael. I mean, I don't want to pick on somebody who's in a hard spot. I've made the judgment watching the interviews that Michael Rotondo is someone who I think could change his situation if he chose it. But I mean, the point's well made here. And as we get ready to close the hour, what would be your advice by age 35? And you can do this in a cheeky way or you can be serious. And Matt, I'll start with you. By age 35.
Well, seeing that I am 35, what should I have done by now?
You should have a daily uniform picked out.
That's a fact. That is absolutely a fact. Have it laid out and ready to go. By age 35, I think you should have a serious conversation with yourself around balance in life and the concept of living long and prospering. Like, what does that mean to you by age 35?
Well said. All right, Chuck Wade.
I think by age 35, we should realize that everyone we encounter is going through something and dealing with something, whether we can see it or not. And we should all just try to be a little nicer.
This is all so good.
So
I know, Sarah, you have to follow those. That's really good.
I was going to say by age 35, you should get used to giving unsolicited advice to people who are younger than you all the time, because that's what I started doing as I entered my 30s.
So
I remember in the early aughts.
As if it was so long ago.
Use aught, so you can't really be a millennial.
I am firmly in the millennial.
I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I think I want to close it on the remarks that Chuck just made. The one thing that their generation, the millennial generation or the Gen Zs, are going to be very good at, whether you like it or not, kids will always grow up with technology now. We're never going back to a world, unless the meteor hits and a small group of us survive and we hunt and gather for a while, we're going to have technology for a long, long time. And our kids are going to grow up and they're going to be really good at it. You've got a 6-year-old, you've got a 4-year-old, I've got a 6-year-old. It's amazing what they can do.
Yeah.
And
how
fast they are with it. The one thing that it can do is reduce a little bit of that face-to-face, which I'm glad to hear you think that generally the generation against the stereotype likes the face-to-face, because that can increase snark and meanness. And me too, mm-hmm. I do it.
Sure.
I don't like it about myself, and I want to keep Chuck's advice in mind. You know, by age 35, keep in mind everyone's going through something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy just to fire off a snarky tweet or, you know, just hit somebody with a little bit of a little online side eye. And I'm not sure that's really, I'm not really sure that's building societal value, to back to Matt's point.
Not at all. I think EQ is going to be huge. As the robots take over, EQ, emotional intelligence of the actual humans is going to be a big differentiator.
Our robot overlords are really coming for the Gen Zs. Good luck, Gen Zs.
Good luck.
But if they don't, we'll be here with more advice for you. Sarah Jones, PR account executive of Dixon Schwabel, thanks for taking the time to join the conversation.
Thank you, Evan. It's been great.
Matt Wagstaff, manager of new sales channels at Excellus BCBS. I love the uniform. Good threads.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good choice today.
I appreciate it.
And Chuck Wade, vice president and financial advisor for Brighton Securities. Always good, Chuck. Thank you.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
More connections coming up.